They say the moon is the prettiest object in the night sky.
Is that right? Depends on how you look at it, I guess.
How do you look at it?
Look out my window, same as anybody.
And what do you see?
Very, very far away tells tales from the future. Each episode is a designed fiction inspired by conversations and narratives collectively crafted with space enthusiasts and experts in various cultural fields. Very, very far away explores and depicts a fantasized future using space exploration as a lens to discuss the values and ideologies that may inform future societies.
Today's episode is inspired by a co-inquiry run at Space Studios headquarters in London during January 2016.
Moonshine. Yeah, like
actual moonshine. What do I see from my window? Rocks and lots of them, slowly moving like clouds across the blue crescent. You know what? Sometimes it rains.
It rains?
Yeah, sometimes there's incidents. A cover will burst and debris will come flying down at us. Sometimes you can get some mineral out of it, but sometimes, well, you're not so lucky.
Where John's left leg should be, there is what can only be described as scraps of metal bashed together until they resemble something like a classic car exhaust pipe.
It's my hot rod.
Wow.
It's not so bad. In this gravity, it doesn't really keep me from getting around.
John Beckman is a retired miner who's living in the original lunar outpost. Built inside one of the tunnels left by the passage of lava under the surface of the moon, the naturally made refuge was chosen to shield the first settlers from solar radiations. Access to the outpost is via the main airlock, which is covered in lunar regolith. The electrostatically charged dust particles that levitate above the main entrance give it a hazy silhouette, which makes it difficult to spot. John's part of the second generation of spacefarers, a program aimed at extending human presence in space.
It looked like you had a question for me.
What happened with the first generation? How long ago was that?
So you're going to ask me a question directly that's built into the narrative of the episode.
Yes.
Well, we're assuming that the first generation of spacefarers were more like the current astronauts. They're more trained as engineers, and they're more the people that set the pipeline, so to speak, you know, that were really invested in building things like the International Space Station, more than people that are specialized workers.
Second generation is specialized workers.
Yeah, that's what we're implying, and that the characters in this show that we're interviewing are miners, and so they're not trained to build the station that they're on, but rather to work in it.
Similar to how Antarctica is set up.
Yes, well, I suppose, yeah. I mean, Antarctica, we're not interviewing scientists in the context of the fiction
right.
yet. Antarctica has a lot of scientists, but there's all kinds of
people that just work in the cafe.
Right, that
too.
Are not,
yeah.
strictly speaking, the architects of the station. Yeah.
Exactly. And tell us the background of this project. How did it get started?
Yeah, so very, very far away started with a couple friends of mine, Andrew and Satraka, who are designers. Broadly speaking, what they do falls into the category of speculative design, meaning you're using design to sort of, you know, formulate a hypothesis. So this whole project is very much a narrative version of that idea, building from contingencies, et cetera.
And how do you find that this kind of medium is effective?
Well, I mean, part of the answer is I'm an audio and storytelling person, so this seems to fall under this would speak my language, in other words, according to my show. But I find that, you know, in terms of addressing the authority of the broadcaster, the natural authority that we give to a broadcaster and to a show that is broadcast as a listener, again, this is very much from the point of view of somebody who consumes a lot of media.
Mm-hmm.
I find that building the show that is purposely fictional in the form of a reportage is the only way to sort of address that relationship. It's the appropriate response for me.
And so set up this whole, because this is episode zero.
Yeah, this
not
is
even
our
episode
prototype.
One.
Our prototype episode.
And set up this whole series as for,
Ooh.
We're at
well,
the beginning.
Okay, in fact, the non-pitch for the whole series, because it's not something that has suspense or anything like that, it's rather sort of an exploration
right.
of a general area. We're showing different fragments of a world that we're designing for all intents and purposes. So each one of the episodes focuses on a certain technological situation that's we're imagining in the sort of like early generation of space exploration. So the following one will be, you know, having to do with what you do to a body when somebody dies in space, and sort of the murder mystery that can entail there. It's not so much that they're open-ended narratives, but they're like sort of, you know, fragments and portraits of a larger situation.
Let's listen to some more.
Yeah.
It's part of a resurrected space policy of the early 21st century that piggybacked on Moon Express's eighth continent after the decommissioning of ISS. I met John in the resting alley of the outpost, a long corridor with walls covered in washed-out postcards of Earth's landscapes, like a giant collage filled with notes and wisdom of pioneers and early settlers. The artificial lighting and ambient sound are meant to echo the plastic flowers and flocked grass, the kind you'd find on a scale model. This strange depiction of nature is intended to help the moon dwellers cope with isolation, but it's an odd experience. John and I are seated on airport furniture in the middle of this synthetic memory of an Earthian garden. How long have you been here?
Here is, inactive, you mean? Whew, let's see,
John, like others here, isn't technically a retiree. He's inactive, but officially still on mission. There is no free market here, and as inactives, their habitat, their clothes, everything that supports their life, are all proprietary items of Planetary Resources, a company specialized in near-Earth asteroid mining. PR for short.
Planetary Resources, shaping space for you.
He's been here longer than most of us.
That's Susie. She's a friend of John's.
I've been here 7 years.
Oh, okay. That means I've been here 15. 15 big ones.
Often too weak or too ill after years spent in zero or low gravity, miners like John don't have many choices and often remain in the outpost. But John is in his 50s, which is quite old for a resident, and has an infectiously optimistic outlook on the world.
Worry doesn't do me no good. 15 years isn't that long compared to... I mean, it's kind of long, but... I know some people been here longer. They're a bit funny in the head, though.
For John and his colleagues, space dwelling has nothing to do with having a dream come true. In stark contrast with the pioneering effort of prior generations, John was part of the second wave of workforces. Those whose lives were dedicated to maintaining robotic systems and ensure the proper transit of materials back to Earth.
What do I do? Well, until the deluge when that Vixenfo's cover tore open, I was a miner. I mean, more specifically, flight assistants. Just making sure the drone fleet got the right flight path, but that was a long time ago.
I see, and now?
Oh, now I make this.
John makes moonshine. That's right. Moonshine on the moon.
It's pretty good, too.
The station functions like a commune. Since registered time spent mining is the only credit unit, there is no currency here, and of course, retired members of the community thereby don't get a salary. That means the community has to rely on barter and cooperation to sustain their living. As a result, cleaning another member's habitat is a popular thing to volunteer to do, especially when you consider some of the less attractive options.
Some repairs are bad. Believe me, you don't even want to know how a toilet works here.
John gets out of most repairs by trading some of his moonshine.
This is the new batch right here.
Is it always this color?
It's always some color. The moonshine is extracted from comets, you see. The flavors and the colors come from other chems. If they're there at extraction, then they stick around after the distillation.
Batch composition can differ from comet to comet. Some may contain high levels of ammonia, for instance. The process was inspired by the refining of ethanol fuel used to power small rovers and resupplying drones. It's not famous for being good for you.
Some people have too much fun.
Here is one of John's video tutorials. You may have seen it online.
This is pretty much the setup. Let me show you what we got going on there. Now, this is our mash. Still a few frozen bits in there. The heart of the comet. I'll pour it down here in the boiler. Now, watch the temperature. I don't know if you can see it. It's about 150 degrees. Need to get up to about 170, 175 before it starts boiling and going up the still. You can see the temperature on the still's not even moving yet, so it's not quite ready yet. But when it hits 170, you'll see it'll start rising. This boiler is actually just a small little kit boiler I found in the drone bay. I actually got, here, let me show you over here. I got, couple more boilers now. This one's about 30 gallons.
John's videos have been viewed millions of times. He uploads tips almost every week.
Coming up to temperature now. As you can see, any time now, should start dripping out some alcohol. Now, for those of you who are having issues with achieving the right balance of heat, you may want to try this. You swap out your batteries every 2 hours. Now, this requires very attentive care, but it'll help you keep the heat steady.
Isn't it illegal?
Technically. Probably.
Yeah. I'm going to jump into my own narrative.
Jump
here.
Into your own.
No, I just wanted to mention here that part of what's going on with this fake YouTube tutorial, that basically we're never positioning the piece in time. We're just assuming it's a sort of what-if kind of scenario. But somehow, sort of through the process of writing it, what keeps gluing it to realism somehow ends up being sort of references to the web and kind of contemporary practices of, you know, tutorial making and building that specificity was sort of really what one of the things that really excited me to work on.
And to draw us into the current context, we're at the Getty, and this is part of Kay Chung's residency for Breaking the Lens.
Breaking the Lens?
Ooh,
breaking the Lens of the
breaking
News?
Breaking the News.
Breaking the News.
Breaking News, the Lens of Mass Media, right?
Oh, yeah. No. It's, yeah. We're going to get it.
We're going to get it.
Mass Media, Turning the Lens on Mass Media.
Turning the Lens on... Breaking News, Turning the Lens on Mass Media.
And I can almost read it from here, but yes, the poster's a bit far.
And we just did a quick tour of the exhibition, which is really, really good.
Outstanding, yeah.
It's outstanding. And it did bring up a lot for both of us before getting on air. And
yeah.
And especially with this current time and what's going on with news and this new term, alternative facts, and the fake news,
yeah.
And real news, and what is news, how does this piece play into that right now?
Well, I mean, of course the piece got, I thought of doing a project like this way before the expression fake news was in my radar, but I think it's really important for artists and for anybody with a creative mindset, whether or not you're a producer, even if you're a listener or a viewer, to keep in mind that fiction is actually sort of perhaps the truth to hang on to in these times, acknowledging fiction as such rather than having rhetoric about sort of the various truth that you may argue about. And I think in terms of a sort of for any kind of political aim or for any kind of program, you have to understand that you begin with a fiction always.
Yeah.
And so I'm not even going to sort of get into naming names or sort of like, sort of the whether or not there's a problem about manipulation of facts within any kind of moment in media, but rather that to recognize the always to recognize the power and the importance of fiction. That sort of has to be my built-in manifesto and motivation to do something like this and be here, frankly.
Yeah, and it's also I was just as I was telling you on the way over here, I was watching an Adam Curtis video on YouTube last night. Any Given Sunday, and it was about sort of the shift of how. The whole video starts out talking about what is real and what is news and how much is fact and how much is fiction and how things get twisted around and. It also got me thinking a lot about what we're doing here today and the importance of always. Relying on different sources and
but I think it goes
and relying on history and fact and
well, but that's, I think it goes further in that because I think even the Adam Curtis's project also gets sort of hoisted on its own petard of how far you can stretch an argument until it becomes its own conspiracy.
Yeah, exactly.
Not acknowledging that, for example.
Yeah.
Whereas again, I begin from fiction. I think a lot of the work I see there. What's so fascinating about it is that it proceeds from collage very often, or it proceeds from a subversion of an image that is intended to have a certain kind of truth to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really great, I just want to say this, that it's really fun not to work with the image in this context and also to work from the writing in order to not be even beholden to a reference, that you can do a work that will sort of deploy the logic of news, have the sort of a broadcasting authority in a certain sense, but will not even be a reflection of contemporary events, strictly speaking.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm also a geek, so technology is a bit more topical to me than certain things, unfortunately. But yeah, I think that's a big part of what I saw as a sort of resonance and distinction to what's happening in there.
We're getting up to one of my favorite parts of the podcast. So why don't we
let's play on.
Hit it.
Because I'm using PR's gear, but practically, there's no one here to enforce that. We're way too far away. They couldn't care less.
It's actually not regulated under any known jurisdiction. There's no TTB here.
Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau.
So no one to ask the permission to. No one asking for your license or permit. It's no one's land. You can only own the rocks, and not even the giant rocks where these smaller rocks come from. It's all about size.
1967, the moon is common heritage of mankind.
And that's what prevented nations from gold rushing. No one can own celestial bodies, so there's no territories in principle. But the truth is, the more you send stuff out here, the more infrastructures you got, so the more you can own it, obviously. Territories ain't geographical out here. They're like services, so to speak.
Services?
Well, let's say you are sharing the loading bay, or that you go check your stuff from the workshop. The place and the tools are all the same, but the rules shift depending on who you're working for, PR or Deep Space. Who provides the service decides the rules.
Deep Space Industries is another asteroid mining company, sharing facilities in the outpost and specialized in long-distance asteroid recovery.
I don't know if it makes sense, but what I mean is if PR was a nation, its border would be its people. Where they are, that's where PR is.
I wish my moonshine would make me travel.
That makes me travel, John.
Susie is right. But moonshining has become a widespread problem for the community. The practical realities that have held the miners captive and isolated have led many to despair and to social and cultural impoverishment. When he was working, John was remote controlling drones from asteroid to asteroid. John's been here for so long, he recalls going for months past Mars on an asteroid capture mission around the belt to drag a few boulders back into the moon's orbit.
That's right. That was the early days of OC.
OC, optical communication, also known as laser communication in outer space.
The CubeSats didn't reach as far as they do now. The network was still relatively new, so remote controlling those or troubleshooting problems with so much delay wasn't an option. So we had to go too, in our little tin can.
Today, John is confined to the outpost, but keeps himself busy with his videos. His videos have gotten more and more elaborate. His expertise makes him a beacon for the outpost community. Once a lunar month, his friends gather at Susie's to share some moonshine. The ambiance is lively.
And then, here, try some of this.
Should I?
On Susie's insistence, I take a swig. Will it burn? It may burn, she says. The sickly narcotic liquid slides down my throat, depositing a translucent film of corrosive quicksilver. The moonshine's initial descent throws a warm towel over my body. My peripheral vision begins to wobble, until eventually my sight shrinks down to a pinhole in front of my nose. A second later, an itch runs across my face. My eyes water, and my mouth dries up. I exhale.
Ah! Fuck! That's strong!
When they are done laughing at me, John tells me how he lost his leg.
Well, yeah, like I said, it was raining when the cover around Vixinfo burst. That was one of those fragments that we'd mined and bagged for years till there's probably more dust left than rock. Maybe AI got confused or something, but we dug till we pierced the bag. Time I had no clue the cover burst, and only realized when the rain came around from the other side and smashed into the module that was mine. Mine wasn't punctured, but the shock from the impact shattered the dash and glasses flying everywhere. Kind of like a slow motion explosion, and the airlock shut off. I was lucky.
Susanna, you had a question?
Yes. So tell us about the narrator of this piece.
Yeah, so there's a couple things. It's really fun to get a narrator who's claiming to have authority on something really drunk, because it opens a door for the story to sort of shift and have a sort of a little reflexive moment.
Yeah.
the it's the person who voicing the nameless narrator is part of another project of mine, The First Human Born in Space. And that's how you and I started working together, how I started working with Creative Migration. A good friend, Jordan, who's an actor, plays a lot of nameless characters in what I do, and often I'm realizing is getting cast as the broadcaster in all these projects.
Is he the first human born in space in this?
So he's not the first human born in space in this piece.
See, I thought
right.
He was.
I see. Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. That's confusing. There was no backstory.
So he's
to
your
him.
Muse.
Well, he's my muse, and he's the voice.
Yeah, he's the voice.
He's the voice in my head.
So then who is the narrator in this? Is he
it's
a
unspecified.
Reporter?
He's a journalist.
He's a journalist that got sent to deep space.
Yeah, who's really, you know, attempting to draw out portraits of these people and sort of cannot help but judge them, I think, is what's happening. We're realizing as we progress with this project.
Well, and one aspect that I found interesting was talking about these areas in space, how it's can't be owned
right.
by anyone, but yet all these space corporations are starting to have these proprietary
right.
Holdings, which happens here,
yeah,
and what is a possible future.
I mean,
and it's something important to talk about and think about as a probability.
Yeah, essentially we're playing out the idea of sort of, you know, within any kind of legal loophole,
mm-hmm.
Sort of, you know, startup culture may disrupt as they claim to, for better or for worse. And I think, you know, part of the idea there is that we think about territory in a very sort of much more regimented fashion here. And this consideration about outer space and who owns it really by default becomes, you know, owned by private interests rather than by any kind of, you know, global commons.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both for sharing such amazing concepts and insights. I'm going to be thinking about territory and possibilities like who owns the news even?
Well, right,
who owns the future of the news?
Rupert Murdoch owns a lot of the news right now, but there's also
I'm not naming names.
Other interests. Well, he was also outlined in the Adam Curtis video I watched last night, so that's why I'm just mentioning that. Also, before we close, if people want more information about this project, there are a few websites with very easy URLs.
Yes. Very, very far away is vvfa.space.
Space. Easy. Jasmine's
JasmineBlasco.com.
BLASCO. And Jasmine with
no
E. And then Creative Migration is creativemigration.org.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And where can we find, what's the name of your radio show one more time on K-Chung?
Oh, so that's your radio show.
Well,
yeah.
My radio show, but this is the K-Chung news bit, but my radio show is The Charming Mistakes of My Youth, which is every third Thursday from 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
And I've been on there playing terrifying French music. I encourage you to revisit.
Yeah. So you can visit all of that and also the getty.kchung.com.
It news. All goes
dot
down
news.
In the archives.
Yes.
Check out the archives.
Thank you very
Thanks
much
for having,
having us be a part of this.
Thank you for coming along. Let's all give it up one more time. Far, far away.